Welcome to the Science Update Podcast. I'm Bob Hirshon, and this is the podcast for February 20th, 2011.
The Science Update Podcast is produced by AAAS, advancing science, serving society.
These receptors in our mouth that detect sweet and salty and bitter are also found throughout our body. And so the whole body is tasting food. The part in the mouth is the conscious part.
It's been known for a number of years on a local scale that birds and bats during migration follow weather fronts. But for the first time on a broader continental scale, we can now quantify this using this network of radars.
You can imagine a future where you get a full body MRI scan and have that on file in case something happens and you need a spare part.
We're here at the 2011 AAAS annual meeting in Washington, D.C., talking to scientists from all over the country and the world who've been making exciting discoveries during the past year. Scientists like Hod Lipson, who says we may one day be able to create replacement organs with a printer, and Thomas Kuhns and Philip Chilson, who are leading an effort to monitor animal behavior in a neglected part of the world, the aerosphere. But first, Suzanne Bard sat down for a chat with biological scientist Gary Beecham of the Monell Chemical Senses Center about how we perceive flavor.
Gary Beecham's face lights up when he starts talking about our sense of taste. And when he describes his job, it's no wonder. Taste testing Europe's finest olive oils and watching how grown-ups respond to drinking different kinds of baby formula sounds like a lot of fun. He's particularly excited about one recent discovery.
And really, we don't quite know what it means. What's been discovered just in the past 2 or 3 years is that these receptors in our mouth that detect sweet and salty and bitter are also found throughout our body. And so the whole body is tasting food. The part in the mouth is the conscious part, and that's what we perceive, and that's what we think of taste. But in our gut, in our pancreas, we've got the same receptors. And so they're detecting sugars or sweeteners or bitter substances, and it's telling our body that either nutrients are coming in or poisons, and causes us to have all sorts of responses to that. So we've really got a sense of taste which goes through the entire body.
That may sound like a curious bit of trivia to file away, but Beecham says that taste receptors in other parts of our body may be an important factor in how we deal with foods that we often eat in excess, like sugar, and could factor into the obesity epidemic. So understanding them better could have a positive effect on public health. But where do our food preferences come from?
My own research has been particularly interested in how we develop a liking for particular flavors.
He says it all starts in the womb.
We've been studying how flavors that are consumed by pregnant women are transferred into their amniotic fluid. And the babies in the amniotic fluid are able to smell and to taste these flavors. And they learn about them. And so when they're born, they already have experience with flavor. And that leads them on to the next step. Those babies then are fed milk from the mother. And the milk also has flavors that are transmitted from what the mothers eat into the milk. And that forms the basis for the beginnings of liking for flavors. It really forms the basis for the beginnings of food culture. And those kinds of early experiences, we believe, and we have some data for this, really are permanent. It's a little bit like learning a language. Little kids are much better to learn languages than older kids. And we believe flavor learning is the same thing, and particularly early flavor learning in utero and during the first maybe 6 months of life set the stage for what we will like for the rest of our lives.
Which gets us back to why he and his colleagues subjected otherwise sane adult volunteers to baby formula. He says there's a type of formula for colicky infants that contains milk proteins which have been broken down into their constituent amino acids. Well, it turns out that amino acids don't taste very good when they're not actually part of a protein. They're bitter and salty and generally vile.
That formula is, to me, the worst tasting thing I've ever tasted in my life. It's just awful. It has a bitter taste, it has a sour taste, it has a bad smell. It's one of the few things we've tested on adults and had people throw up. It was really bad. But if you give this to an infant before he or she is 3 months old, they consume it with no problem at all. And if you continue to feed it to them, they will consume it absolutely wonderfully. And we believe we'll continue to like those flavors for the rest of his life. But if you take an infant who's 6 months old and give it the first time to that infant, that infant does the same thing I do. It retches. So something happens in this very sensitive period.
He says it should surprise no one who's been around children that most kids hate bitter foods.
Little kids really hate bitter things, and that's why they don't like vegetables, because they're bitter. And that's wise, because many things in the real world are bitter, and they're poison, and they're dangerous. But low levels of bitter compounds are actually healthy.
Bitter foods like coffee, tea, and alcohol in small quantities contain antioxidants and could have really important health benefits. And for reasons that we don't entirely understand, many adults find these bitter tastes compelling. Beecham says both ibuprofen and extra virgin olive oil cause a painful sensation in the throat when chewed and swallowed, and it turns out that both contain anti-inflammatory compounds. In extra virgin olive oil, this compound is called oleocanthal.
When we Googled that the day before we published the paper, there was no hits. 1 month later, there were something in the order of 190,000 hits, something to show about the power of the internet for sure and creating new words. So anyway, we think this is an important compound, and the thing that I find most interesting is that what it's doing is it's stimulating pain receptors. And when we give really good olive oils to the typical American who's not used to them, they don't like it. It hurts. They hate it. Yet if you go to the Mediterranean area, this is a sign of a great olive oil and people love it. How do they know that that's good for them? I have no idea, but apparently there's something during acculturation that has allowed them to learn, and I'm using learn in a sort of a very generic sense, that this is something that ought to be good for them, and it actually turned it into something that they really like.
He and his colleagues are also investigating how salt interacts with receptors on the tongue. This could lead to the development of salt enhancers or even replacers, decreasing the amount of salt used in foods, which is a good idea because it's a risk factor in heart disease.
Thanks, Suzanne. Organ transplants are often hard to come by, and there's a high likelihood of rejection. But in the future, it may be possible to literally print some organs out on a printer. Cornell roboticist Hod Lipson says 3D printers that resemble dot matrix printers already exist, and they could be modified to deal with human cells.
One of the fascinating implications of 3D printing is this idea that you can print with multiple materials. You can print with metals, with ceramics, with other materials. One of the really exciting opportunities when it comes to multiple materials is the ability to print with biological materials. So what does that mean? It means printing with live cells. So imagine that you could take cells from, let's say, a torn meniscus, cartilage in the knee, take those cells, culture them, and then make more cells, put them in a special ink that's biologically compatible, and then print a three-dimensional new meniscus from those cells, and then take that new meniscus and implant it back in the person that had the torn meniscus to begin with. It's not a plastic implant. It's not a one-size-fits-all. It won't wear. There's no rejection. It's an original part, so to speak. It's made out of the same cells of the donor. It really bypasses a lot of the issues that you traditionally have with implants made out of artificial materials.
He says it may never be possible to print something as complex as an eye. He says researchers are starting simple, but over time, the technology will get more sophisticated.
You can have cartridges with different cell types, and then you can start printing heterogeneous tissue. Let's say you want to print a spinal disc. It has different cell types in different locations, and that will be a fantastic way to print a spinal disc that can be implanted. It has all the different pieces in the right place, so to speak. It has the central structure with one cell type and the periphery with another cell type and so forth. So you can really print a three-dimensional biological implant with all the right cells in the right place. You can imagine a future where you get a full-body MRI scan and have that on file in case something happens and you need a spare part.
Next, Suzanne says there's an understudied part of the world that's finally getting its own academic discipline.
By sheer area, this habitat is larger than any other on our planet, so it's surprising that so few scientists have studied it. I'm talking about the aerosphere, the boundary layer above the Earth, and home to bats, birds, and many insects. Boston University ecologist Thomas Kuhns and University of Oklahoma atmospheric scientist Philip Chilson discuss with me the need for a new field of study. Here's Kuhns.
Aeroecology is an emerging discipline that incorporates the domains of geography and biology and atmospheric science to understand the movements and the activities of organisms in the airspace above our feet. The boundary layer above the Earth, where organisms move and spend a good part of their lives.
What has been missing in terms of studying these organisms?
Well, what has been missing is really integrating different disciplines to understand the influences, for example, on air density, wind, precipitation, and anything else that happens, the airflow patterns on organisms that spend their time flying or passively moving through the air. It's quite amazing when you look at the organisms that are in the air. Most people can go out and look up in the air and all they see is blue sky or they see clouds. And we are the same way, but we have technologies now that have emerged over the last number of years to actually probe into this atmosphere, ranging from thermal imaging to new technologies in radar. And this has opened up a whole new way of understanding this environment.
Kuhn says studying what's going on up there could help track and predict the spread of certain infectious diseases, or help builders of wind turbines avoid sites that bats and birds frequent, since they tend to get killed in large numbers by wind turbines. Philip Chilson, the radar expert, says studies of airborne animals tended to be limited before, but recently, researchers have been taking advantage of large radar networks.
The U.S., in particular, has about 510 radar installations across the continental United States, continuously observing the airspace. And now we have a tremendous resource that we can utilize for observing the biology.
And Kuhn says that's exciting news for biologists.
It's been known for a number of years on a local scale that birds and bats during migration follow weather fronts. But for the first time on a broader continental scale, we can now quantify this using this network of radars. And so this is a very exciting opportunity to understand more about what's above our head. Currently, the technology exists to quantify how many raindrops are in a cloud. And if you can do that, we can also quantify the number of insects, the number of bats, and then how the bats respond to the insects. And this has important implications in terms of understanding the impact of global climate change on airborne organisms, because the air mass changes, the temperatures change, the precipitation patterns change, and this could also influence movement patterns of birds, bats, and insects.
Chilson adds that meteorologists also stand to gain from aeroecology research.
Whenever you have a thunderstorm, it produces a downwash of cold air, which then rushes away from the storm. It's called an outflow boundary. And insects have developed evolutionary patterns where they surf these outflow boundaries. And then the bats have also developed evolutionary patterns such that they can know that the insects are in these outflow boundaries, and they know that's a nice place for them to start feeding. And so we have some examples where you see an outflow boundary on the radar because it's full of insects and therefore causes higher reflectivity. And then as the bats are emerging, they are not flying out in their normal pattern, but they recognize the outflow of insects. And then you can see the bats flying along this pattern of the outflow and are feeding on it. So it's really a fascinating interplay between the insects and the bats, and it benefits both the meteorologist and the biologist.
So next time you go outside, remember to look up and think about the world that exists above your head.
Thanks, Suzanne. The United States has vast wind power resources, but according to Imre Guke, Program Manager for Energy Storage Research at the Department of Energy, wind speeds vary greatly and tend to be highest at night when energy demand is low. That's why the DOE is funding pilot programs that use wind power to store compressed air underground.
You can do it in salt domes, in abandoned lime quarries. You can do it in abandoned oil wells, a lot of different possibilities.
The compressed air runs turbines to create electricity when it's needed most. He says that pilot projects now underway will produce up to 450 megawatts of power. Additional projects are testing the feasibility of storing the compressed air in metal pipes above ground.
And then when you need the energy, you use a hydraulic motor to run an electric generator. So this system would be completely green, and it may be fairly efficient, and you can put it any place you want to because you're using steel pipes to contain the pressurized air, and you free yourself from the geological constraints.
He says they're also doing pilot projects to store energy in more distributed, flexible, and local ways. For instance, hanging large battery units on telephone poles right near transformers. Then, people living nearby who have household windmills could charge up the batteries during off-peak hours, and the batteries could feed excess power back into the grid during peak hours. The battery units could also be used as charging stations for electric cars. And best of all, Gueuc says they could make the units cheaply by recycling batteries from electric cars.
Because these lithium-ion batteries in the electric vehicles are really only useful until they have reached about 80% capacity, because lower capacity means lower driving range. And so after they reach 80% capacity, they would be traded in for a new one. And the old battery may be what could be used in these community energy storage, or possibly even bigger batteries.
The other cool thing about some of these energy storage options is they could provide backup electricity during power failures. The Department of Energy has funded a bunch of these pilot projects with stimulus funds, all focused not on generating energy in new ways, but on storing and distributing energy in innovative ways that make current green energy sources much more practical. Well, that's all we have for you this week. Next week, what predicts persistent stuttering in children? A surprising discovery about Braille and the brain, and why speaking a second language could help stave off dementia. Until then, tune in to the Science Update Podcast Daily Edition every day, Monday through Friday. You can find it on our website, scienceupdate.com, or at iTunes. You can also check out Science Update's fan page on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. And if you have a science question, give us a call at 1-800-WHY-IS-IT. If we use your question, we'll send you a Science Update mug. Thanks for listening. I'm Bob Hirshon for AAAS, the Science Society.